Hello, this is Sky and Telescope Editor-in-Chief Robert Noya. I'm on the phone with Dr. Jim Casting, Professor of Geosciences at Penn State University. Besides being a renowned expert in the evolution of planetary atmospheres, Dr. Casting is actively involved in NASA's search for habitable extrasolar planets. He was one of the sources for Jeff Heck's cover story, Glimpsing of an Evolving Planet, in our August issue, and he is the author of the newly published book, How to Find a Habitable Planet. Dr. Casting, thank you for joining the S&T podcast.
Okay, hi Bob, nice to be here.
Great. Well, Jeff's article describes how Earth has changed dramatically during its 4.5 billion year history, and that as we start finding Earth-sized planets in the habitable zones around other stars, we're going to see these planets at different stages of their evolution, just as Earth has evolved over time. What do you see as some of the important lessons that we can draw from Earth history that will help planetary scientists such as yourself interpret what we're seeing when we start finding these exo-Earths?
Well, of course, the most important question is, are there other Earth-like planets out there? Many of us think that there must be, but we don't have any proof of that. We've studied, my students and I have been studying the evolution of our Earth for a long time, and there are big changes, as you said, that have taken place, probably the most important one being the rise of oxygen about 2.5 billion years ago.
The article talks about that being a really key transition because it allows new types of organisms to evolve in more complex life.
Well, that's right. All plants and animals respire. You know, we breathe oxygen. Even plants need oxygen in order to live. And so that has opened up this whole new biosphere. If we see a planet, you know, eventually we hope to be able to measure the composition of a planet's atmosphere. And one of the obvious things to look for is oxygen and also ozone that's produced from the oxygen. But you wouldn't see that if you looked at the Earth during the first half of its history.
Yeah, so I guess, you know, an alien astronomer looking at Earth from a distant star, I mean, they would have seen very different chemical signatures in our atmosphere at different times. Like, when would alien astronomer really been able to point a scope at Earth, you know, a very advanced telescope, and say, hey, that's a planet that almost certainly has life on it?
Well, this is exactly the kind of question that we're starting to debate at astrobiology meetings. You know, I think if we saw a planet like the Earth that's well within the habitable zone, the region where you can have liquid water on the planet's surface, and if you saw oxygen or ozone in the atmosphere, you'd say it was probably inhabited. But, you know, if you didn't see that, doesn't necessarily mean that it wasn't inhabited, because you wouldn't see that on the early Earth. And we think life got started on Earth probably by at least 3.5 billion years ago. So there was a billion years during which time the Earth was inhabited, but there was little or no oxygen or ozone.
And probably during that period, it might have been difficult for aliens to really determine that Earth had life unless they could visit and look at it up close. Is that correct?
Well, we think there would be differences between a biotic planet and an abiotic one. We think, for instance, that the methane concentration would go up enormously when life got started, because methanogenic bacteria are probably ancient. But whether or not that would be considered definitive evidence for life, I bet there would be a lot of debate about that.
Yeah, because, for example, I mean, we've detected small amounts of methane in Mars's atmosphere, and, of course, Titan's atmosphere has a lot of methane, and yet I guess most people or most scientists don't think that those are necessarily signatures of life.
Right. Titan's atmosphere is methane is several percent, but that's, you know, Saturn's way out at 10 AU, so that's pretty easily distinguishable from an Earth-like planet. The surface temperature on Titan is very cold for that reason. But you pointed out the methane in Mars' atmosphere, it's only a very small amount, if it's there at all, and so you wouldn't be able to detect that on an extrasolar planet. There's just not enough of it. But it does point out, I mean, that methane, if the Martian methane is real, it could be biological, but it could be being produced by abiogenic processes.
And I know that NASA is currently flying the Kepler mission, which should, over the next few years, give astronomers valuable information about the frequency of Earth-sized planets. but it's my understanding that these planets are going to be too far away to really be able to probe or study directly. So is that correct, that we're going to have follow-up missions to really start finding the exciting planets that might show signs of life?
That's exactly right. Kepler, they're unfortunately sitting on their data right now. My understanding is they've got a number of candidates for Earth-like planets, but we're not going to know about it for at least another 8 or 9 months. Even if they find such planets, though, you're right, those ones are too distant. The average distance is something to a Kepler target star is something like 2,000 light years. And we need to find planets around stars within, 10 or 20 light years in order to study them spectroscopically.
Right, and what kind of technology will be required to do that, to really get this good enough spectroscopic information about an atmosphere, you know, that might tell us what kind of life or non-life is on the surface? When might we have such a capability?
Well, we could do it as early as 8 or 10 years from now. Actually, NASA got started 3 or 4 years ago on a mission called TPFC, Terrestrial Planet Finder Coronagraph. And that was going to be a big space-based visible telescope that would block out the light from the star and look for the reflected light from the planets around it. We think we know how to do a mission like that, but we have to get the go-ahead, and it's a fair amount of money, about probably a minimum of $5 or $6 billion.
Yeah, so I guess it depends more on Congress than the technological capability of the scientific community.
It actually depends on the astronomical community itself, because the astronomers are in the final stages of doing their decadal survey. You know, every 10 years they get together, this is a National Academy-sponsored thing, and they plan out the big missions for the next 10 years. So we'll see early September whether the decadal survey has picked TPF. My guess is that they won't.
What kind of atmospheric signatures would signify the likely presence of life, and do you think we could get unambiguous detection?
There's a fairly unambiguous detection that you can do if you can, and this was suggested 50 years ago by James Lovelock, the author of the Gaia hypothesis. So he proposed back in the 60s that the simultaneous detection of either oxygen or ozone and a reduced gas like methane or nitrous oxide, if you saw those together in a planetary atmosphere, that would be not completely unambiguous, but that's pretty solid evidence for life.
Mm-hmm. And why would that be?
Well, in Earth's atmosphere, you've got, let's think about methane and oxygen. The atmosphere is 21% oxygen. Most of that is from photosynthesis. Our atmosphere has about 1.7 parts per million of methane, which is also biological. That's produced by methanogenic bacteria. And these gases are more than 20 orders of magnitude out of thermodynamic equilibrium with each other. Neither one would be there unless it was continually resupplied by life. So it's pretty hard to do that without having life on the surface of a planet.
Now, in your new book, you talk about a lot of these issues that we've been discussing. What motivated you to write your book, How to Find a Habitable Planet?
What motivated me was two things, really. One was our funding got cut off for TPFC, and so I wanted to think what I could do to get us back going again. And the other thing that motivated me was there was a book published 10 years ago called Rare Earth by Peter Ward and Don Brownlee, and they're rather pessimistic about the possibilities of not Earth-like planets in particular, but complex life, including intelligent life. And, you know, I disagreed with some of the points that they made, and so that's part of my book as well.
Yeah, because I was actually just about to ask you about that in their book they took, as you just said, a very pessimistic outlook on the commonality of planets in our galaxy with complex life. I mean, they did say there could be huge numbers of life-bearing planets, but they argued that those planets would just have very simple microbial-type life, that planets with, you know, more advanced life like plants and animals should be very rare. So given the fact that it took Earth billions of years to get to the point where we had really complex plant and animal life, what makes you think more optimistically than Ward and Brownlee?
Well, they've actually got about 10 or 12 different arguments in their book why the Earth is unique. Let me just pick one, plate tectonics. So they point out quite correctly that plate tectonics is involved in climate stabilization on Earth because it modulates the carbonate-silicate cycle that controls atmospheric CO2 levels on long timescales. But then they say Earth has plate tectonics. Then they say within our solar system there are 20 large solid rocky planets or large moons, and of those Earth is the only one that has plate tectonics. Hence, plate tectonics is rare, and therefore, you know, this is one of their reasons for thinking that complex life is rare.
But you would think that plate tectonics might be more common than they argue.
Well, that's right. So, you know, let's think about Venus and Mars. Mars doesn't have plate tectonics, but that, you know, the reason why is pretty obvious. Mars is only about a tenth of the Earth's mass, and so it cooled off too quickly. It may have had something like plate tectonics early on, but it doesn't have enough internal heat. So you need a bigger planet. Now, Venus is almost as big as the Earth. I think it's 8/10 of the Earth's mass, so that's not the big issue. But Venus doesn't have any water, and water is probably very important for plate tectonics. It lubricates the asthenosphere, the upper part of the mantle on which the lithospheric plates slide around, and it cools off the basalt as it's extruded at the mid-ocean ridges. So, and to a lot of us, you know, the reason why Venus doesn't have plate tectonics is probably largely related to its lack of water. And that's because it's too close to the sun. So it's not that plate tectonics is necessarily rare.
You also talk about how, in the Ward Brownlee book, they make the argument that a planet like Earth would need a very large moon, you know, to stabilize the obliquity and, you know, and absorb some impacts, etc. And yet you argue that maybe a large moon might not be necessary to have complex life on a planet.
Yeah, that argument, you know, comes from Jacques Lascar over in Paris. And Jacques is an extremely competent celestial mechanician. But what you've not stated in the Ward and Brownlee book, and in most places where you see this discussed, is that the Earth's obliquity, if you just took the moon away, the Earth is spinning with a 24-hour day length, and if you just take the moon away, then yes, Earth's obliquity becomes chaotic. But if the Earth was spinning faster than a 12-hour day, then it goes back into the regular regime again. And so you get to the question, well, what would the Earth's rotation rate be if you didn't have a moon? And then you start thinking about it. The moon has been slowing down the Earth's rotation by tidal drag. So we think that initially the Earth was rotating with a 4 or 5 hour period, and that's been slowed down by the moon. But then it doesn't stop there, because you ask, why was the Earth rotating so fast early on? Well, that's because of the moon forming impact, most likely.
Another thing, too, that you've written a lot over the years and done research about habitable zones, and making the argument that we should broaden our concept and realize that stars might have broader habitable zones than were previously considered. Could you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's actually how I got into this whole field 30 years ago or more, when I was a graduate student, because this was back in the late 70s, and there was a planetary scientist named Michael Hart who had written a couple of papers arguing that the habitable zone, the liquid water region around our sun and around other stars, was extremely narrow. I hoped at the time that that was not the case, because I was a follower of Carl Sagan, and I wanted to think that there was a better chance of having life out there. What Hart's model didn't have in it was this feedback between CO2 and climate, which is related to plate tectonics that we just talked about. And when you put that in your model, then as the climate cools, CO2 builds up in the Earth's atmosphere, and that helps to counteract the cooling. And so this makes the outer edge, the habitable zone, move much farther out than it was in Hart's model. So that's why I'm optimistic on that point.
Yeah, so taking all of these factors into account, I mean, it seems like you at least think there's the possibility that there could be very, very large numbers of planets in our galaxy, not only with simple microbial life, but maybe more advanced life as well. Is that a correct explanation of your current thinking?
Well, I think it's possible. You know, that's probably not testable. I'm most interested in testable things. And what we can do with these terrestrial planet finder missions, if we get them built, is we can look study the composition of a planet's atmosphere and look for things like oxygen and ozone and methane. And if we find that, that will be just wonderful. I think that will tell us to a reasonable certainty whether life exists out there, but it won't answer this question about complex life. That one is more difficult.
And what might it take to answer that? Would that require something like interstellar travel or getting lucky and finding something interesting in the solar system?
Well, you know, people like Frank Drake and Jill Tarter, the SETI group, have been looking for intelligent life for 40 years or more. So if you find somebody that builds radio telescopes, you can detect them that way. But if you just find, you know, if you're looking for advanced animal life, say the Earth during the time the dinosaurs were running around, there's no radio signals, but dinosaurs don't modify the atmosphere in any detectable way. So, yeah, you might have to have interstellar space probes to detect life like that.
And in terms of detecting life, always a possibility that, you know, maybe there are, maybe the methane on Mars, for example, is from methanogens, and there's very simple, you know, microbial life on Mars, or maybe a place like Europa or Enceladus. And then there's also the possibility, you know, that some of the nearby stars might have terrestrial planets with life on them. If we are to find life on other planets, do you think that it's more likely we'll first find it in the solar system, or do you think it's more likely we'll have to look out to outside our own solar system?
I think, actually, that we'll find our first evidence for extraterrestrial life outside the solar system, because it's actually easier to do that than it is to find it within the solar system. You know, that may sound counterintuitive, but to do it outside the solar system, we need one of these terrestrial planet finder missions, which I just estimated. It's a big space-based telescope. I estimated the cost at $5 or $6 billion. Maybe it's twice that. I don't really know. It hasn't been costed. But Mars is the best candidate in our own solar system for having life. But that life, is, if it's there, it's probably deep subsurface. Mm-hmm. Deep by deep, I mean a kilometer or two down where the liquid water is thought to exist. And so finding life on Mars would require going there and drilling a kilometer or more beneath the crust. I think that's way more than $5 or $10 billion.
Yeah, I would think something like that, you're probably talking about a human mission, and then you're talking, you know, tens or even hundreds of billions of dollars.
NASA has, you know, I've seen some cost estimates for just getting people there back safely, and the estimate I saw was $400 billion.
Yeah, so that's a lot of money. Probably a little bit more than we're willing to spend right now.
Well, that's half the stimulus package, right? So that is a lot.
Yeah, that's definitely, we're talking real money there. Well, that answers the questions that I had. Was there anything else that you'd like to discuss that I did not ask you about?
No, you asked good questions, so that's most of what is in my book, which I hope people will find interesting.